Isaiah 15, verse 1. An oracle concerning Moab. Because Ar of Moab is laid waste in a night, Moab is undone. Because Kir of Moab is laid waste in a night, Moab is undone. He has gone up to the temple and to Dibon, to the high places, to weep. Over Nebo and over Medeba, Moab wails. On every head is baldness, every beard is shorn. In the streets they wear sackcloth, on the housetops and in the squares, everyone wails and melts in tears. Heshbon and Eleala cry out, their voice is heard as far as Jahaz. Therefore the armed men of Moab cry aloud, his soul trembles. My heart cries out for Moab. Her fugitives flee to Zoar, to Eglath-Shelishiah. For at the ascent of Luhith they go up weeping. On the road to Horonaim they raise a cry of destruction. The waters of Nimrim are a desolation. The grass is withered, the vegetation fails, the greenery is no more. Therefore the abundance they have gained and what they have laid up, they carry away over the brook of the willows. For a cry has gone around the whole land of Moab. Her wailing reaches to Eglaim. Her wailing reaches to Be'er Elim. For the waters of Dibon are full of blood. For I will bring upon Dibon even more, a lion for those of Moab who escape, for the remnant of the land. Send the lamb to the ruler of the land, from Selah by the way of the desert to the mount of the daughter of Zion. Like fleeing birds, like a scattered nest, so are the daughters of Moab at the fords of the Arnon. Give counsel, grant justice, make your shade like night at the height of noon. Shelter the outcasts and do not reveal the fugitive. Let the outcasts of Moab sojourn among you. Be a shelter to them from the destroyer. When the oppressor is no more and destruction has ceased and he who tramples underfoot has vanished from the land, then a throne will be established in steadfast love, and on it will sit in faithfulness in the tent of David, one who judges and seeks justice and is swift to do righteousness. We have heard of the pride of Moab, how proud he is, of his arrogance, his pride, and his insolence. In his idle boasting, he is not right. Therefore, let Moab wail for Moab. Let everyone wail. Mourn, utterly stricken, for the raisin cakes of Kir Haresheth. For the fields of Heshbon languish and the vine of Sibmah. The lords of the nations have struck down its branches, which reached to Jazer and strayed to the desert. Its shoots spread abroad and passed over the sea. Therefore I weep with the weeping of Jazer for the vine of Sibmah. I drench you with my tears, O Heshbon and Lelela, for over your summer fruit and your harvest the shout has ceased. The joy and gladness are taken away from the fruitful field, and in the vineyards no songs are sung, no cheers are raised, no treader treads out wine in the presses. I have put an end to the shouting. Therefore my inner parts moan like a lyre for Moab, and my inmost self for Kir Hareseth. And when Moab presents himself, when he wearies himself on the high place, when he comes to his sanctuary to pray, he will not prevail. This is the word that Yahweh spoke concerning Moab in the past. But now Yahweh has spoken, saying, in 3 years, like the years of a hired worker, the glory of Moab will be brought into contempt. In spite of all his great multitude, and those who remain will be very few and feeble. So reads the word of the living God. How does God feel about the destruction that he himself brings on idolatrous sinners? The Bible gives us a glimpse in a handful of passages. Genesis chapter 6, verse 6, because the heart of man was only evil continually. God regretted that he made man and was, the text says, grieved to his heart. Psalm 78, verse 40 says that because of the rebellion of Israel continuing to plunge themselves into idolatry and turning away from God, God was grieved over them. Isaiah chapter 63, verse 10, similarly says, "But they rebelled and grieved his Holy Spirit. Therefore he turned to be their enemy and himself fought against them." And when you get to the New Testament, it's the same picture. Jesus, in Luke chapter 19, verses 41 to 44, just after the triumphal entry into Jerusalem in Passion Week, surveying the whole city of Jerusalem with all of its idolatrous blasphemy against God himself, the God-man weeps over the idolaters of Jerusalem, knowing the devastation they will receive. "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how many times I would have gathered you to myself, but you would not come. And so, your time is short, and there will be siege ramps raised up against you because you did not know the time of your visitation." God is grieved, grieved, when idolaters reject him. Now, that's a complicated thought because of a doctrine known as the impassibility of God. Impassibility just means he doesn't have changing emotions. This is an extension of the unchanging nature of God. Malachi chapter 3, verse 10, "I, the Lord, don't change." God is a God who doesn't change in any way, so he doesn't change in emotion. Even the word emotion is probably improper to use because it has the word motion in it. It sort of implies some sort of change, doesn't it? Passion implies some sort of rise in affection. God doesn't experience that. God has perfect affections always. He can't have better affections, better emotions about anything. He is maximally perfect in every regard. So what does it mean then to say that God is grieved? To say he's grieved by sin, by idolatry? Well, it's really just a way of, the fancy theological term for it is anthropopathism. It's a way of saying that something that we experience maps onto God in an approximate way, not in a perfect way, not in a one-to-one way. In the sense that because God is compassionate, because God is merciful, the extension of that compassion and mercy and pity towards sinners who deserve his condemnation is that he does not want their condemnation. He wants them to turn. And yet at the same time, injustice does bring the judgment that they've provoked. And this grief of God is perhaps nowhere in Scripture more obvious. There's perhaps no text in the Bible more stained with divine tears than these two chapters, Isaiah 15 and 16. And in the grief of God over the judgment of wicked Moab, we see a glimpse of the large heart of the Lord and an encouragement for us to grieve like him. Now, in the context, we're looking at the judgment oracles of the nations, Isaiah chapter 13 to 23. These 10 oracles focused on some 9 different nations, at least. There's actually a few more scattered in there, in which God is pronouncing judgment on all of the pride of mankind. And we've already looked at a few chapters he spends excoriating Babylon and his time spent showing Philistia how they were not reading history correctly. Now he turns his sight to the nation of Moab, who, as we've noted before, is associated in particular here, not just with pride in general, but with the pride of idolatry. The pride of idolatry. Each of these nations represent in some way a particular form of pride or a particular vice that pride gives rise to. And here it's the pride of idolatry for the nation of Moab. You see in chapter 15, verse 1, the framing of these two chapters, an oracle, a masah, a lament concerning Moab. Who is this nation, Moab? Well, Moab, is first mentioned in Genesis 19. Genesis 19, Lot is fleeing from Sodom and Gomorrah as God destroys it, and he goes to a little town called Zoar. It's a little town because Zoar just means little. And doesn't stay in the town, but goes and stays in a cave with his two adult daughters, who then have the bright idea to intoxicate their father and sleep with him in subsequent evenings, apart from his knowledge, in order to become pregnant, and they do. And the first one, the oldest of his two daughters, becomes pregnant by her father, has a son, and names that son Moab from his father, literally the name of the nation that comes from him. From the beginning, Moab was from a line of idolatrous compromise. In essence, is sort of the remnant of Sodom and Gomorrah. In fact, they're not certain about this, but it seems likely that Sodom and Gomorrah were in the area where Moab then rose to prominence. Moab took the land of the Emim, east of the Dead Sea, particularly the area south of the Arnon River. If you see in this map, the Arnon River kind of cuts it in half. The northern part is what Reuben took. Southern part is what Moab took. Now, Moab would extend at various points over that border and conquer all the way up to Mount Nebo and Mount Pisgah. That's where they were, for instance, when the Israelites first came to the Promised Land. So all these cities, a number of them show up in this text, and we'll look at this map again later, were the land of Moab. And you'll notice even potential sites for Sodom and Gomorrah and Zoar at the southwestern corner of it. This land is a relatively small land for the cousin of Israel. It's slightly larger than Rhode Island. And in the history of Moab, we find not only did they rise to a sort of prominence during the time of Abraham and beyond, but they had conquered some of this land until the Ammonites conquered them. Numbers chapter 21, verses 27 to 30. The Ammonites sing a song of victory over the Moabites and identify them as the people of Chemosh. Chemosh. Chemosh would be the national god of the Moabites. He was the prized national deity of Moab. This may be a depiction of him. This is from a stone that was found in that area. The middle figure potentially could be Chemosh. We don't know for sure. That's a good guess. 1 Kings 11:7, he's called the abomination of Moab. 2 Kings chapter 3, verse 27 reveals that the Moabites offered Chemosh human sacrifices. One of the kings murdered his adult son and burned him on a wall as a plea to Chemosh. He's seen as sort of a warrior god, the god who leads them into battle and fights for them. The famous Misha steel, also called the Moabite stone from the 9th century, you could see it today if you go over to the Louvre, still in existence there. It's a detailed record from a Moabite king named Misha thanking Chemosh for his successful rebellion against the nation of Israel, which is in fact exactly what's recorded in 2 Kings chapter 3. So it actually corresponds quite well with what we see in the Bible and tells us quite a bit about their worship to this god Chemosh. Well, as time went on, the Moabite king Balak made himself a stench to the people of Israel, of course, by doing what? Hiring a false prophet to try to prophesy against Israel. That didn't work out well for him. But he wasn't one to give up, so he instead had Balaam trick the people into sexual morality by intermarrying with the Moabites, and they did. Numbers chapter 25, verse 3 tells us that the Moabites also worshipped Baal of Peor. So they had a pantheon of gods that they were worshiping and led Israel into that false worship. Reuben, as you see on the map, settled just north of Moab and fought often with them. Oh, sorry, this is the Misha steel. I didn't show that to you, but that's what it looks like. Judges chapter 3, verses 12 to 30. records the solitary 18 years in which Moab had conquered Israel. Only 18 years in their entire existence. It's during the time of the judges. People were wicked, and so God gave them over to King Eglon. He's the big fat king, you remember? And then the judge Ehud comes along and stabs him. And so that didn't last all that long. This is also during the time of Ruth, the Moabitess. Saul defeats Moab, 1 Samuel 14, verse 47. David made them serve Israel as slaves, 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 2, which lasted for centuries until Misha's rebellion in 2 Kings chapter 3. And then Moab was sort of its own sovereign nation for a couple hundred years until the prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Amos, and Zephaniah, and Ezekiel, all prophesied judgment oracles against this nation, Moab. Eventually, these prophecies led to their destruction by what Ezekiel 25 calls the people of the east. It seems first an Assyrian invasion and then later total decimation by Babylon. There were some Moabites who apparently survived that exile. Nehemiah chapter 13, verse 1 and 23 tells us there's still some around, but the nation from that point forward is no more. It's dead and gone. Just a mere remnant is left. Its idols, for all of their pleading, could not save them. And it is this unique judgment oracle on Judah's cousin nation in which we hear God predict the oncoming Assyrian invasion, I think, which will decimate the nation, he says, in 3 years' time from the point of this prophecy. We don't know for sure when that is. It might have been that this was in 715 BC, and 713, 712 is about when Assyria came back to that area and destroyed Moab. So it could have been that time. We don't know for sure. But whatever it is, there's some sort of oncoming devastation by an army, what he calls the lords of the nations in chapter 16. And God pours out his heart of compassion for this wicked, idolatrous nation, even in the midst of their obstinance. It takes the form of a kina, a Jewish lament. It's highly structured. It's deeply poetic, as is often the case for Isaiah. A lot of assonance, a lot of alliteration, a lot of rhyme. It's aimed at provoking in God's people a kind of deep well of emotion for the destruction of their unbelieving neighbors. It's not only written such that the Moabites could have read it. Their language was pretty similar to the Hebrew language at the time, so they probably would have been able to read it. But it was especially for the sake of Israel, the Judah, the southern kingdom, so that they would read it and feel God's burning compassion even on their enemies, even on idolaters. And I think that's how it should function for us too. Acts chapter 17, you remember Paul goes into Athens and he sees the city is full of idols. In Acts chapter 17, verse 6, it says, he saw that the city was full of idols, so he was greatly distressed. Romans chapter 9, verse 2, Paul says of unbelieving Israel, I have great sorrow and unceasing anguish for my kinsmen according to the flesh, fellow Jews, because they are cut off from Christ. And I wish that I myself could be cut off for them. But Paul has the same heart for unbelievers that God displays in this text. And it's a thought-provoking text to us. How do we feel about our unbelieving neighbors? The idolaters in our lives, maybe in our families, maybe just down the road from us, maybe in the cubicle right next to us. What's our response to them? How do we feel? Do we have this kind of compassion that God has, or do we feel a relative indifference? I hope that this text will provoke in you a deep sense of compassion like Paul had and like God has for the lost. Now, this is, as ever, a complex and thoughtfully structured text. You'll notice in the slide here, this is a chiastic text, as is often the case for Isaiah. And so he's framing the whole thing around Moab's petitions to its god, Chemosh, likely. And then a kind of geographical movement on the B section of this text, and then in the center of it, God actually making an offer to the people of Moab to be saved, which they then spurn and reject. So that's going to be our outline for this evening. We'll just walk through it each piece, one by one, as we see the heart of God for idolaters that He Himself will destroy. So, first, when God weeps for the godless, Moab wails to their God. Look at verse 1. It says, an oracle concerning Moab. Because Ar of Moab is laid waste in a night, Moab is undone. Because Kir of Moab is laid waste in a night, Moab is undone. These are two major cities, probably the two major cities in Moab, felled by surprise at night and in an instant, just one night. Meaning, when this devastation comes, there's no recourse for it. There's no getting out of this. You can't flee from this because you didn't even know it was coming. And you can't stop it because it is so powerful and sudden it happens in a single night. There's no way to escape. This is utter destruction. And notice the language. It says Moab is undone. That's the exact same language that Isaiah uses of himself in Isaiah chapter 6, verse 5. Woe is me, I'm a man of unclean lips, I'm undone. Because I've seen the king. They've seen the king, but just in a different way. They've seen his fury. And so in verse 2, their response is to go up to the temple, literally to the house, and to Dibon, a site of cultic worship for them, to the high places to weep. Their response, when they face adversity, when they face destruction, is to go to their false gods, and the wailing begins. There's profound mourning described in Moab here. In the course of these two chapters, there are 10 different verbs that are used that all describe mourning in some way. Mourning, longing, crying out, wailing, melting, crying aloud, cry of destruction, wailing, over and over and over again, just these pictures of intense lamentation. It's like a funeral for a nation. It's hard for us to imagine what that would be like. Maybe think of it like if in an evening, New York City and Washington, D.C. were devastated by some foreign army. And you woke up and you see that on the news. Like, how would you feel? Knowing that the rest of the nation's going to fall, that's the position they're in. And so where do they go with their grief? They go to their idols. Goes up to the temple, to the high places, the places where they would worship their false god. And notice, not just to the high places, which would be basically any sort of large hill or mountain. They had lots of mountains strewn throughout Moab. But especially to the temple, to Dibon. They went to the highest place, the most sacred place they could go to, which is how false religions usually work. There's some place that you got to go to that where you really get heard. And so they go to the place they think that Chemosh will listen to them. They seek refuge in their false hopes, in their war god. They cry out to him, save us. They're weeping to him. That's the idea of the picture here in verse 2. They're saying, please save us, Chemosh. Save us from the devastator. But it's clear that Chemosh isn't listening. Because it says in the latter half of verse 2, over Nebo and over Medeba, Moab wails. That's a city just at the base of Mount Nebo in the north. Medeba, a village just along the King's Highway, which would run straight through Moab. They're wailing. And then notice the language here. It's meant to be comprehensive in its description. On every head is baldness. Baldness is shaving your head in mourning. Every beard is shorn, taken off. In the streets, they wear sackcloth. On the housetops and in the squares. Whether you're in the house, you're out of the house, you're in the streets, you're on top of the house, wherever you are, you're mourning. Everyone wails and melts in tears, literally goes down in tears, falling on the ground. This is absolutely everyone, everywhere, every tear being poured out for the destruction of this nation. And then look at verse 4. Heshbon and Elealeh cry out. These are two of the northernmost cities in Moab. Their voice is heard as far as Jahaz, likely a city on the eastern border, close to the desert. This is just saying encompassing a large area. And the consequence then of their crying out is that the armed men of Moab cry aloud. His soul trembles, meaning the strongest men, the warriors, the mightiest Moabites are shaken in their boots. They're undone as well. They're crying out in desperation. They can't do anything. They melt into a puddle of woe and despair. The whole nation, God says, is being overwhelmed with grief and turning, predictably, to their idols. And it isn't it interesting that that's still what happens today? When people who don't follow the Lord encounter some sort of tragedy, encounter some sort of hardship, where do they go? They go to their idols. They go to whatever God, whatever resource they think is going to give them relief. Save me. But in this case, it's not going to work out, because after they wail to their God, they're going to be led out of the land of Moab into a kind of exile. Moab flees to the south in chapter 15, verses 5 to 9. Look at verse 5. It says, "My heart cries out for Moab." That "my" there has to be God. You might think, well, maybe it's just Isaiah talking. Well, look at verse 9. He says, "For I will bring upon Dibon even more." Look at chapter 16, verse 9. "Therefore I weep with the weeping of Jazer." Chapter 16, verse 10, "I have put an end to the shouting." That's not Isaiah. He's not claiming responsibility for causing this destruction. No, this is God. And in case you're not convinced, Isaiah says in chapter 16, verse 13, "This is the word of the Lord." This is God's word. God is the one speaking here. This is God crying out for Moab, lamenting on their behalf over what he himself has done to them. Hearing no response from Chemosh, the Moabites then take matters into their own hands. Notice verse 5, "My heart cries out for Moab, her fugitives flee to Zoar." And what you're going to see, all these place names that follow, is sort of a southern descent. I'll show you a map so you can see some of the place names there. A southern descent, starting probably from Horonaim or Kir Harasheth, going all the way down to Zoar, you see at the southwest border there, and eventually even further south into Edom to an area called Selah, which we'll see in the next chapter. So it's a kind of refugee movement, if you will. This is them fleeing, fugitives, getting out of the way of destruction. Listen, Chemosh, he's not listening to us. Our warriors, they're not doing anything for us. So the best I can do is just get out of town. Just try to get to safety, save myself. God grieves here because rather than them running to God for shelter, they are just running down into the rocks in the desert. And so it says, "Her fugitives flee to Zoar, to Eglath-Shelishiah." There's some debate about that particular term. Some think it is a heifer who's 3 years old. Some people think it's a place name. I have no idea what it is. Nobody's been able to find a particular place called that. Maybe there was. Not entirely sure. But for sure, the following are place names. At the ascent of Luhith, that would be just a village on the slope of a mountain, they go up weeping. So they're leaving from where they were and they're migrating down to Zoar. And on the way, they're hitting Luhith. They're going to Horonaim, another city, and they raise a cry of destruction, meaning of their own destruction. The waters of Nimrim are a desolation. It might be a river there. It might be certain springs. We're not sure. The grass is withered. The vegetation fails. The greenery is no more. Apparently, the army, as it's coming through, is just burning everything. Therefore, the abundance that they have gained and what they've laid up, they carry away. So because the army that has invaded them has burned all of their crops, they just have to take whatever they can put on their backs and in their wagons and take that along with them over the border, over the Brook of the Willows, which would have been the southern border, They're leaving their land. For a cry, verse 8, has gone around the land of Moab. So the whole land of Moab is in devastation. Her wailing reaches to Eglaim, that would have been up in the north. Her wailing reaches to Be'er Le'im, that may have been in the south. It's sort of like from Dan to Beersheba, probably. The whole of the land is mourning and wailing and gnashing and crying out. Why? Verse 9, for the waters of Dibon are full of blood. It may be waters of Dimon, other texts say. The point here is that he's using a well-known image to the Israelites to describe their devastation. This is an image from 2 Kings chapter 3, verse 22. At that time, Ahab's son and Jehoshaphat joined with the king of Edom to march against Moab. And as they were encamped, they asked Elisha to help them. And because Jehoshaphat was on their side, Elisha's like, I don't like the rest of you guys, but I like that guy. So I'll give you a prediction. He plays some music and he gives them a prediction. And he says, I'm going to rout the rest of these men. I'll give you water and rout the rest of these men. So God brings miraculously some water to these three armies and he slakes their thirst. The Moabites wake up and in the morning they see all of this water. And because the way the sun is hitting it, it looks like big pools of blood. And so they think, oh, the armies have killed each other. Let's just go in and mop up the rest. And so they do, to their own demise. Israel wakes up and they just slay the rest of the Moabites and they get run out of town. So that is the image that's being conjured up here, except now it's not just water that looks like blood. Now it's water that is filled with blood. It says, the waters of Dibon are full of blood. The blood of Moabites are running through the streams because of this devastation. But it's not just that. He says, for I will bring upon Dibon even more, a lion for those of Moab who escape and for the remnant of the land. Basically, he's saying, hey, listen, however bad this destruction is, if you do manage to escape, you who are running to the hills, eventually all the way down to the rocks of Edom to find some sort of refuge, even then you won't escape. You're not going to get out of this judgment because I'm going to send something after you into the rocks. It's going to be a lion. It seems to be a picture here of another nation. I think probably an image meant to represent Babylon, which in the 600s, early 600s, is going to devastate Moab entirely. So basically, they're trying to run for safety themselves. Chemosh wasn't listening. All right, I'm going to save myself. And God says, that won't work either. There will be no escape. Fleeing won't save you. Your idols won't save you. The desert won't shield you. You cannot run from God. But God does make them an offer, and that's the next part of this text. Moab spurns the true God in chapter 16, verses 1 to 6. God turns to instruct Moab how they might escape his wrath. Essentially, God is pleading with them here. This is what he says in 16 verse 1. And there's a lot of debate about exactly who's speaking in these. So this is my take on it. I could be wrong, but this is my sense of what's going on here. I think it's God speaking to the Moabites. And he says, send the lamb to the ruler of the land from Selah, by way of the desert to the mount of the daughter of Zion. Selah, also called Jokthiel in 2 Kings 14, is, it seems, the modern-day city of Petra in southern Jordan, which you would know if you've seen which Indiana Jones movie? Raiders of the Last Ark. Last Crusade, thank you, Last Crusade. Yeah, it's the outside facade there, the temple that's cut into the rock, that's Petra, right? Okay, so that's where they went to hide. They went south, that's apparently where they landed. And so God says, down there, from down there, in your hiding, send a lamb to the ruler of the land, meaning the ruler of the land of Israel or of Judah, because it says to the mount of the daughter of Zion. Why do that? Well, two reasons. Number one, back to 2 Kings chapter 3, under David and his followers, his successors, and the Israelite kings, Moab was made to pay a yearly tribute of 100,000 lambs. And this word lambs is actually a kind of rare word for lambs. Not the typical word. It's only used 9 times in the Old Testament to talk about lambs. So this is a pretty unique use of the word that I think is mapping directly onto 2 Kings chapter 3. They used to pay tribute to them 100,000 lambs a year. But when King Misha came along, the same Misha of the Moabite stone, that king said, no, we're not paying that anymore, and he rebelled against them and succeeded. So what he's saying here is, well, don't pay tribute to Ahab and his people anymore because they're gone. But you should pay tribute to Judah's king. You should seek refuge under the wings of my people. You should go to the place where I have promised my people refuge, humble yourself, and come underneath my shelter there by way of the desert. You're going to have to come up through the Negev, but do it. Because, verse 2, like fleeing birds, like a scattered nest, so are the daughters of Moab at the fords of the Arnon. Right in the middle of the land, the fords right through the mountains there would have been the prized possession of Moab. All their women are scattered like birds who have been scared away. There's nothing left. Their nest is empty. There is no hope up north. That's what he's saying. There's no hope for you back home. Don't think that you're going to be able to reconstitute this thing yourself. You need my protection, he's saying. And so go to the Davidic king. Go to the ruler whom I have promised protection, which would be Hezekiah at this point in time, if my guess is right on the timing. Go to him and seek refuge there. And then he turns his attention in verse 3 and he speaks directly to the people of Israel and he tells them what to do if Moab is to come to them. He says, give counsel, grant justice, make your shade like night at the height of noon, shelter the outcasts and do not reveal the fugitive. He's saying, get together your counselors and make a decision and agree that you're going to do the right thing. If Moab comes to you seeking shelter, give them shelter, like shade at night, meaning a big dark shade at the height of noon. The blazing midday sun's coming down. You shelter them perfectly. Don't reveal them. Don't show them to the enemy. Verse 4, let the outcasts of Moab sojourn among you. Let them be as one of you. Be a shelter to them from the destroyer. The destroyer, just the oncoming army that's trying to undo them. God is telling his people, have mercy on this nation. If it comes to you like I've instructed them to, have mercy on them. And God gives the reason to Moab why they should do it in the latter half of verse 4. He says, when the oppressor is no more. I don't know about that translation. It's really the word, it's key. It's probably better translated for. And I think he's talking about a future time here. And he says, for the oppressor is or will be no more. And destruction has or will cease. And he who tramples underfoot has vanished from the land. I think what he's saying is, Moab, you should come and find refuge in my people because they're going to give you shelter. And while you hide there, I'll deal with the oppressor. I'll deal with the one who's destroying you. That's the only way it could go away, right? The one who tramples underfoot, the one who has been upending your land, I am going to take care of him. And verse 5, a messianic prediction, then a throne will be established in steadfast love and on it will sit in faithfulness in the tent of David, one who judges and seeks justice and is swift to do righteousness. He's saying Christ is going to come one day and he's going to do away with all the destroyers, all the enemies. So if you're looking for a lasting refuge, people of Moab, there's only one king to go to, and it's the Davidic king. That's why he says the tent of David. It's a unique phrase. It's not used anywhere else in Scripture, the tent of David. But this language is used all over the place in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 13, when God makes his promise to David. In chapter 11 of Isaiah, we've already seen this language of one who judges and seeks justice and does righteousness and has a belt of faithfulness around his waist. This is very clearly a messianic prediction, and so he's saying, listen, Moab, your only hope is to come to the house of David where you can have everlasting refuge. Not just temporary. Not just for a moment. but you can be sheltered underneath my wings forever. This is a gracious offer from God, isn't it? This is an idolatrous nation who's been attacking his people and worshiping false gods for generations. And God is like a pleading evangelist, begging, urging them to be saved. It almost reminds me of George Whitefield. You remember the famous 18th century evangelical preacher. He said this, quote, "Would weeping, would tears prevail upon you? I could wish my head were waters and my eyes fountains of tears, that I might weep out every argument and melt you in love. Would anything I could do or suffer influence your hearts? I think I could bear to pluck out my eyes or even lay down my life for your sakes." And you know what? God did. That's precisely the point of the gospel. That God so loves sinners. Sinners like the Moabites. Sinners like you Americans. That he laid down his life. That he shed blood. That he wept tears in Gethsemane for the likes of you and me. God is the great evangelist. The great caller of men to refuge in himself. Oh, how God weeps for his enemies. And that's what we see here. God pleading with the people of Moab to come and find refuge in the house of David. But the sad thing is how they respond. Verse 6. "We have heard of the pride of Moab. How proud he is of his arrogance, his pride and his insolence. In his idle boasting, he is not right." The report goes out. Everyone now knows. Moab, not interested in the refuge that God provides. "No, we can take care of ourselves. Thank you very much. We don't need Yahweh. We've got our gods." They were famously arrogant. Even a direct plea from Yahweh himself left them unfazed, certain in the superiority of their God and of their self-salvation. And notice just how plain Isaiah puts it. He says, "In his idle boasting," idle is sort of an addition of the ESV translators there, but it's not wrong. "In his boasting, he is not right." I mean, just factually. Pride is always a belief in a lie. You're just wrong if you think that you can outrun God. If you think that you can find refuge outside of God, you're just incorrect. You won't, is his point. Their boasting is going to end in tragedy. They've believed the lie of prideful idolatry, and they will go down with that ship. And that gives way to their starvation in the north. Moab starves in the north. Chapter 16, verses 7 to 11. The consequence of their rejection of God's offer, verse 7, "Therefore, let Moab wail for Moab." I tried. I gave you the offer. But you've decided, so let them wail. Let everyone wail. "Mourn, utterly stricken, for the raisin cakes of Kir Harosheth," one of the delicacies associated with that part of the world because of their vineyards. They would dry them out and make special pastries out of them, I guess. None of that's left. It's all going to be destroyed. And then from verses 8 to 11, he describes the once verdant landscape of Moab like a vine that's getting cut into pieces, as a way, an image of describing their total agricultural decimation at the hands of the Assyrians. The destruction of their food source and their eventual starvation. Look at verse 8. "For the fields of Heshbon languish, and the vine of Sibmah." Those are two northern cities. And what you're going to see, Jazer, Sibmah, Heshbon, Elealeh, all of those are towards the northern part, closer to the Jordan River Valley, a more lush area, where they would have had vineyards aplenty, but now they're being chopped down. The vine of Sibmah, the Lord of the nations, has struck down its branches. Assyria and eventually Babylon after it is chopping off all the limbs of these trees, which at one point, verse 8, reached to Jazer, reached even further north. These massive vineyards and strayed even into the desert where there shouldn't be a vineyard. And its shoots spread abroad and passed over the sea. They even had some territory of Israel at some point. And all of that is being chopped up and thrown into the fire. Verse 9, therefore God says, I weep with the weeping of Jazer for the vine of Sibmah. You'll notice even here the chiastic structure of the town names, Jazer in the middle, Sibmah, and then Heshbon on the outside. This very tightly constructed lament. He says, I drench you with my tears, O Heshbon and Elilah. I mean, God is going over the top to describe the kind of compassion that he has for this wayward nation. What was most prosperous is now shriveled. Now it's cut off. And he goes on to describe what, during the height of Moab's reign, might have been a season of abundant harvest and shouting and gladness and joy, has now been silenced because of the oncoming enemy. It says, for over your summer fruit and your harvest, the shout has ceased. This is not the joyful shouting of wine treading anymore, but just the sound of weeping, just the sound of wailing and howling. Verse 10, and joy and gladness are taken away from the fruitful field. In the vineyards, no songs are sung, no cheers are raised, no treader treads out the wine in the presses. That's what would have happened in their heyday. It would have had people celebrating at the harvest and flowing wine. But no more. God says, I have put an end to the shouting. And it's been replaced just with more wailing. Verse 11, therefore my inner parts moan. God uses the same metaphor in Hosea chapter 11 of his inner parts. God has, of course, no actual inner parts. God is spirit. It's a metaphor describing again in an anthropopathic way the affection of God. He says, my inner parts moan like a lyre for Moab. At funerals in the ancient world, they would use lyres, like a small guitar or a harp, to play a funeral dirge. The same word is used in Jeremiah chapter 48 to talk about a flute, the playing of a flute at a funeral as well. In fact, if you sometime this week go and read Jeremiah 48, you'll find out it's a little bit longer. It's seems to be Jeremiah taking Isaiah 15 and 16 and reappropriating almost all of the language, sometimes word for word, in order to describe this second destruction. It was Assyria, now it's Babylon, and it's going to be worse. And so the lyre is exchanged for the flute, and the funeral is played. It says, my inmost self for Kir Haresheth. God is lamenting himself over the destruction that this nation has brought on themselves, the downfall of a people. David Brainerd was a missionary to the Native Americans in Connecticut in the 1700s, ended up living with Jonathan Edwards at one point, died when he was 29. In his 20s, he's wandering through the forest, he's of ill health, he's desperately trying to convert the Native Americans in that area of the wood. And one day, he hears that the tribe that he's most near is going to spend their whole day celebrating this idolatrous feast. And so he gets up early in the morning and he starts weeping and praying. This is from his diary, quote, this morning about 9, I withdrew to the woods for prayer. I wrestled for an ingathering of souls. I was in such anguish that when I arose from my knees, I felt extremely weak and overcome. Sweat ran down my face and body. I cared not how or where I lived or what hardships I went through so that I could but gain souls for Christ. Just a question. For those in your life who have rejected the offer of God's refuge, that you want to come to Christ, have you prayed for them? Do you keep praying for them? Do you offer up to the Lord even tears for their sake? Moab starved, and that leads them back to where they were before, pleading to know God. Like most dirges, this one ends in sadness and darkness, circling back to where it began. Look at verse 12 in chapter 16. It says, "And when Moab presents himself, when he wearies himself on the high place, when he comes to his sanctuary to pray, he will not prevail." The Moabite doesn't regard the warnings or the tears of Yahweh, but he just goes back to Chemosh. Just goes back to his God to plead more. He presents himself. "Hey, look at me, God. Look at me, Chemosh." And then it says he wearies himself on the high places, almost kind of like the prophets of Baal. Remember, they were gashing themselves and crying out for hours and hours and hours, accomplishing nothing. You realize that's how idolatry always is, right? It's just wearisome. It just tires you out, and that's about all it accomplishes. It doesn't do any good. Nobody's actually listening. It says it will not prevail. That's because false gods, idols, they're all take and they're no give. They don't actually exist. There is no false god. There is no Chemosh. So he can't do anything. So you can go to his sanctuary and pray, but it's not going to save you. He won't prevail. Only God, the God of Israel, can hear. Their prayers to their false god go unanswered. But in verse 13, Isaiah wraps this up and says, "This is the word that Yahweh spoke concerning Moab in the past." Sort of an enigmatic phrase, not entirely clear what Isaiah means by that. Maybe that there were just other prophecies about Moab that had already been given, and this was just following in suit. Maybe that this very same prophecy had been given by Isaiah himself multiple times during his life. May have been the case. Amos chapter 2, verses 1 to 3 is an actual prophecy against Moab by someone who's a contemporary with Isaiah, so maybe that. Could have been a reference to Numbers chapter 24, verse 17, where Balaam himself pronounces that the forehead of Moab is going to be crushed by a star from who rises from Israel. Either way, he's saying, listen, all of this has already been said. Here's the horrifying new information, verse 14. "But now Yahweh has spoken, saying, in 3 years, like the years of a hired worker, the glory of Moab will be brought into contempt." Like the years of a hired worker is watching the clock. He doesn't miss a minute. So this is saying in 3 years and in precisely 3 years, no more. In 3 years from the time that this prophecy is made, Moab's going down. Whatever it was boasting in will be brought into contempt. It will be a matter of mockery. In spite, it says, of all his great multitude. Oh, you had a big army, did you? Oh, you had all of those vineyards. You had those massive temples. Where are they now? It says, in spite of all his great multitude, and those who remain will be very few and feeble. They'll have no strength left, and there'll be barely any of them. God brings to pass promptly this destruction that he prophesied. What are you supposed to do with a lament like this? Well, I think what you're supposed to think about is the Moabites in your life, if I could call them that. The people in your life who also have rejected God's call, who haven't accepted at least this offer of salvation. Maybe you've had a conversation with them already. Maybe you've told them, you've pled with them. You've said, please turn away from your sin. Don't continue down this road. I want you to come and find refuge in Christ. And still don't listen. And I think what you're supposed to do is, with God, mourn. Have a heart of compassion towards that person that doesn't just write them off. I mean, how easy is it for us when someone is in that condition to just say, forget them? I don't want to deal with this anymore. Fine, I told you. Is that the heart of God? Even towards a whole nation of idolaters? No, he weeps when they weep.